874, and the 874 adapter that goes from 874 to type N. I hope the guy you loaned it to gave you back those adapters. If not, that could give you a little bit of a slowdown in your project. Is that true, John?
Oh, no, he apologized. He sent it out first day here. Got it at 8 o'clock the next morning after he told me he was going to send it out. So, yeah, I got that back. Got the whole thing now.
So your trombone, my guess is it's a U-shaped one. My guess is it can change by about 8 or 10 inches. And you've got this vernier dial that can change it in a very precise manner across those inches. Is that true? Or centimeters?
Yes, the stroke varies 15 centimeters total. I mean, you can stretch it a little bit more, but you've got to be careful with them because you can ruin the telescopes inside. So it has, at minimum setting, you've got a 10-meter starting point, so that means you're inserting at least 10 centimeters, that's 20 centimeters continuous on there, and then you can vary it 15 centimeters on one side, so you have to double that. So it's total 50 centimeters, but it's only variable to 30, if you understand, with the trombone.
Yes, I do. That's going to allow you to do some fun things. And that'll be a real strong confirmation of what we're looking for.
We already emailed you some preliminary results with the test.
Very good. I was busy trying to put another piece of hardware at the house back together today, so I haven't even seen my email yet today. Okay, yeah. Wes, what would you like to talk about? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, to actually. Okay. I have sent the material for the test and it's on Bernice, the Bernice family email, so anybody could get into it. So there are two subjects that I would like to discuss. One is the video that was titled The Arrogance of Being Thick as a Brick. And the other one was the Russian scientists developing a system of transmission of electricity over the one wire, and the wire could be much thinner. That is the human hair, and with a tremendous current. And it's a kind of official science right now that is up. Okay. So the arrogance of being thick as a brick. It's a philosophical material. I don't know if you have a chance to see it, but I believe it's a war of your wings. There are some fundamental questions. What is the foundational substance all things break down into? And the second question is... What is the origin of this foundation substance? The third question is, who is aware of all of this? So that's how the video starts. How would you describe the very large, the very small, the very cold? And actually the video states about facts that we try to see and understand and train our perception into understanding that. Say, atom. Atom has the shell scale element and positively charged nucleus. And we were taught that small balls, the small particles at atom are solid. But then, we're told that, yeah, they're waves. Double slit experiment then says, well, they waves, so they are particles. So the particles are no particles, no wave, and they are both, but they are neither. And our intuition falls at that point. Then we're told Neutron and protons are made of quarks, the radioactive quarks. Then, we look at those quarks, we look at the structure, and then you see proton, which is made from, say, U and D, and then neutron antiproton will be anti-U, anti-U, anti-D, says neutron will be UDD, and whatsoever, then we have anti-D, which makes pi plus, then we have U anti-U, which makes plus pi zero, and then we have a K zero. We have so many of that stuff. We're trying to understand that. But then, we see at that video, the very much prominent scientist saying, proton is made out of the vacuum. That makes most of its mass, okay? Empty theory is not empty. Protons and neutrons is a contents of our body, and it's 90% of our body, and it's empty space. Is it foundational? Then black holes. What are they made of? The gravity in black hole is infinity. The time stops. The space makes no sense. Everything we know about physics is invalid. Then we were told dark energy plus dark matter is 90% of our universe. And no one has any idea what it is. Now we're talking about singularities. What is uncertainty principle? Singularity is when understanding of our nature breaks down. So we are with the certainty to uncertainty. Explain to us how and why everything is. Can you? Can anybody? Where do they get this all certainty from, those people who are thick as a brick? Well, the video blames or points into certain directions. Well, the video points at religion, chapters, holy books. They will tell you what is going to happen after the death. But of course, they have no evidence of that other than their subjective interpretation. So that's the part of the deal. I'm wondering, what is that you would say about all of this? And to exchange.
I did see the video about thick as a brick, and I think I saw some of the others. One of the things that I wanted to mention to you is I did a quick back of the envelope calculation during the week along the philosophy of the degree of difficulty of creating a nuclear reaction in an ordinary laboratory, how difficult it is to do. And there's a couple of different ways of looking at it. And one of the ways I decided was, first, if you decided to make a scale model of a helium atom, where the nucleus is 100,000 times smaller in diameter than the whole outer cloud of electrons in that helium atom. And if you decided to make a scale model that looks like the solar system, where the sun is the nucleus, and then the outer cloud of electrons would go out to 537 astronomical units, 13 times bigger than the whole solar system. So if I made a scale model of a helium as a solar system, that atom would be 13 times bigger than our solar system. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is if I was making a scale model of a helium atom, and I'm trying to scale it up to the size of Wembley Stadium in London. Let me drop. Wembley Stadium, I think, is 1,000 meters in diameter, and the nucleus would be a BB in the center of that ball field, an eighth of an inch in diameter. And if you're standing off at a reasonable distance from this helium atom, you're going to be a couple of kilometers away, and you're firing at a target that's an eighth of an inch in diameter in the middle of the stadium. From a couple of kilometers away, I'm going to show you how difficult it would be to hit that target. Because if you're firing bullets at the target where the bullets are polarized, they're either positive or negatively charged, as they try to penetrate the outer shell of the electrons around that nucleus, let me drop. First of all, penetrating that shell is very difficult. It'll seem to you at first like it's made out of iron, so to speak, the shell, unless your particles are moving at a relativistic velocity. They're moving a good fraction of the speed of light, then they can penetrate the outer shell of electrons, and they stand a chance of hitting your tiny little target in the center. But there's a catch. As your particles penetrate that outer shell, they're going to be deflected by that shell, because your particles are either positive or negatively charged, and as they go near individual electrons, so to speak, penetrating that shell, they're going to be deflected. So even if you had active aiming at the nucleus in the first place, they're going to be deflected. The first thing somebody would say is, well, I'll use neutral particles, something that's uncharged. I'll fire neutrons in there. Sounds good. Where are the neutrons going to come from? Where are you going to get relative velocity neutrons? You'd say, out of a particle accelerator. Oh, how do you accelerate a particle that has no charge? The only things you can accelerate in a particle accelerator are things that are negatively charged or positively charged. Protons, usually, and electrons, usually. But they're going to be deflected by that outer shell of electrons as they try to penetrate. So trying to hit the target to create a nuclear reaction is extremely difficult. If you and I set up some helium atoms at the tail end of the Large Hadron Collider, where you've got this really potent beam. Let me drop. That Large Hadron Collider is making beams as dense as you can get them, as compact as you can get them, as fast as you can get them, and you're setting up your target at the tail end of that beam accelerator. Almost all of your particles are going to miss the target. When they do a real experiment, you've got one beam going clockwise and one beam going counterclockwise, and each one of those beams, you've made them as compact as you possibly can. You focus them as best as you can, and you've got a zillion particles in there, and you aim those two beams at each other. Common sense would lead you to believe, I'll aim them at each other for a second and it's all over. These beams, you aim them at each other for a couple of hours, and a few of them hit each other. Very, very difficult. So in a laboratory, to create a nuclear reaction when that target is so darn small is extremely difficult. As such, let me drop. Whenever anybody is doing a brand new experiment and he believes he's seeing a desirable result, a predictable result, if he is an objective scientist, in my opinion, he has to spend 10 times as much time as the original experiment proving that it wasn't an erroneous result. After you get the result that you've predicted, that you believe is a desirable result, in some cases you've got to put 10 or 100 times more effort into the project in order to cross off the list all of the possible misinterpretations. Was the radio signal getting into the wrong place and disturbing the instrumentation, for instance? There's a tremendous number of procedures you've got to go through to prove that it was not a false alarm, that the measurement you made is really what you think you've measured, and you've negated all the possible errors. And then when you publish the article in a peer-reviewed journal, let me drop. In a hell of a lot of cases, some of the people reading the article will find a few more potential errors that you didn't even know existed. So you can tell that I know that one of the one of the patents that you found that looks very encouraging is various materials put into a vial and exposed to 300 megacycle RF energy. And we want to believe that a nuclear reaction is taking place. And you've often heard scientists, when they're being quoted about nuclear reactions that were being experimented with in the 30s, 40s, and 50s of the 20th century, they were talking about target size, and they were talking about the nuclear target, the nucleus of atoms, how extremely small that target is, and how hard it is to hit it. So these are some of the reasons why I'm very skeptical that any of us can do a nuclear reaction in an ordinary laboratory. Now, when it comes to the sizes of things, a scanning microscope, a mechanical scanning device, what's it called now? Nuclear force, what is it now? Force something microscope, you know the one I'm trying to talk about. I believe it can go down to sub-nanometer resolution. And many of the atoms that you're talking about that's on the surface of a smooth material that you want to scan, many of those atoms are a third of a nanometer. And I believe that these atomic force microscope, I think, can resolve numbers slightly below a third of a nanometer. And so mechanically you can do it. Light waves are
repeater, time out.
Light waves are something like 1,500 times too big in wavelength to be able to see atoms. But you can do an XY scan, a raster scan, mechanically, and by feeling the bump, so to speak, of the outer shell of those atoms, you can get a picture of the surface of a material and find out whether or not there's flaws in the surface and whether or not contaminants are there.
Info on that, Dick, when you get a chance.
Yeah, go ahead, John. Give us that info now. KC2WTB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, if you Google Pico microscope, that is the microscope with the most resolution. That is the one they can see atomic structure. Not the structure of the atom, but they can see atoms. But it's a group of atoms, and it looks like fuzzy balls. Now, if you Google that and you look at that, you get an idea of what a waste of time it is with an electron microscope to try to see atomic structure.
Yeah, one of those atomic force microscopes did show you a microscopic picture of the sharp point that's being scanned across the surface. And so you've made an extremely sharp point, and at the tip of that point, you've got a carbon nanotube sticking off, that looks like a hair sticking off, and I think that's the actual thing that they rub off the surface in order to make the atomic force microscope scanned XY picture. That's my impression. I wonder if you've seen that, and I wonder if you got a similar impression, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, I did, Dick. I watched that video, and nice piece of equipment, and very small for what it does. But I also had other questions. If it is looking at an atomic structure, and not by feel, there's two types. They have the tapping one, and then there's one that actually makes a touch. But its surface, the distance from the atomic structure. Now, why doesn't it detect, one of my questions to Wesley, because he was researching this, why doesn't that fluctuate? Because the electrons are traveling around in their orbits. You know, randomly, all fuzzy and all, but that should be indicated on the detector, I would imagine.
No, I don't think so, John. Those electrons are in orbit. I don't know their exact velocity, but I guarantee it's a good fraction of the speed of light in orbit. That electron going around that nucleus, I'm going to pick numbers out of the air. I'm guessing it's making orbits billions and trillions of times per second. And you're mechanically scanning across that atom in seconds or milliseconds. You can't possibly see the motion of the individual electrons. From your point of view, at the rate at which you're mechanically scanning and or coming near, touching, and feeling, so to speak, by electrostatic repulsion. From your point of view, that cloud of electrons around that atom is really a completely shielded surface with no holes. In reality, it's electrons moving very fast, but they're moving so fast, and they got such an extremely strong charge, that you sense that shell as if it is a sheet of metal, so to speak, at a much larger scale. But you can't sense any holes in it. You can't sense the motion of the electrons. The motion of the electrons is billions of times faster than your scanning. And so from your point of view, it's just an impervious thing that you can sense its location. That's my guess as to what's going on. On top of that, because, let me drop it. The surface is at some physical temperature, and it is a solid, what we're discussing right now. And maybe if it's a sheet of silicon, the silicon is really a matrix of atoms that are all locked together in that matrix. And those electrons, or those individual atoms, are shaking in location. That's what temperature is. But I am guessing the amount of shake compared to the diameter of an atom is very small. There I don't know. But if someone told me the amount of shake is equivalent to 1/1000th the diameter of the atom, I would believe it. And the rate at which the shake is taking place, again, is, I'll bet you, billions of times per second. So once again, as you and I scan across it in seconds, we sense the average location of this shaking atom, and we sense that outer cloud of electrons as a thoroughly impervious sheet of material, because they're moving so fast compared to us that we just see it as a continuous sheet of charge, if you know what I mean. So the real atoms, the real shake due to temperature and the real movement of the electrons, I don't think we stand a chance in hell of sensing that. We don't have anything like the speed of sensing to be able to see that. You see where I'm going on that one, John? Much of this is speculations on my part now. This is not my area of expertise. KC2WGB, KQLAW.
Yeah, you're right, Dick, as it is with all of us. But I just thought, in a simple way, looking at the hydrogen atom, then because it not only rotates and spins, the orbit vacillates in its position. So the hydrogen atom would appear to be a solid also. Does that sound right to you?
Well, up to now we've been talking about solid materials, like a sheet of silicon, and you've made it super smooth and super highly refined because you and I are about to make a high-density integrated circuit on that sheet of material by sputtering and electron ion implantation, all kinds of crazy things we're going to do with it. A hydrogen atom is something that exists in the air in the room with you right now. I mean, most of the atoms in the room with you right now are nitrogen, oxygen. Some of them are helium. Some of them are hydrogen. So there are a small number of hydrogen molecules in that room with you right now, John. In the gaseous form, they are moving at 500 meters per second. At that speed, what in the world do you and I want to do to try to visualize them? If I made your hydrogen atoms, let me drop them. If I cryogenically cool them, I can take your gaseous hydrogen atoms, I can bring them down to a liquid. I think it is possible if I had super cryogenic capability, I believe I can bring the hydrogen atoms down to a solid. But now, are we going to operate our scanning nuclear force microscope? Are we going to operate it at 0.1 degree Kelvin? I'm worried about that one. But a gaseous hydrogen atom is moving so fast, I don't think there's any way in the world that you and I could even dream about to try to visualize that thing that's moving that fast, John. KC2WGB, KQLAW.
Okay, that was just a thought. Go back to Wesley, because I'm sure he has more to do.
Yeah, this, I'm going to going to continue for some time unless somebody brings me some good articles on the subject. I'm continuing to be very skeptical about our ability to conduct a nuclear experiment in an ordinary laboratory where you decide that you're going to create the nuclear reaction now. If I start off with naturally radioactive materials, and it's spontaneously doing its thing, yes, I can get some nuclear reactions. But I'm not very much in control of those, per se. But if I start off with non-nuclear radioactive material, and I try to create a nuclear reaction, I can see 1,000 ways where Mother Nature's going to stop you and not let you do it. Because just hitting the target is so extremely difficult. And without hitting the target, I don't know how we can say that we're doing a nuclear reaction. Chemical reactions are using that... Let me drop this. Chemical reactions are using that outer layer of electrons around those atoms. We're not coming within a mile, so to speak, of that nucleus when we do that.
Further question, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, let me comment that.
If we take a piece of pitch blend and we brought that down to zero, absolute zero, would the radiation continue?
Okay, by pitch blend, I think you're trying to say we've got a so-called black body material. We got material that's got very high...
radium.
Say that again, John?
A pitch blend, they produce radium from that. So let's take a sample of pitch blend because you can detect radiation from it.
Okay, so you've got a spontaneously nuclear reactive material. And what you and I call temperature is average kinetic energy of the individual atoms because of physical motion. In other words, when a substance, solid, liquid, or gas, is at some particular temperature, when it's gas, we talk about the velocity of the atoms. When it's a liquid, we talk about the velocity of the atoms. When it's a solid, we talk about the amount of shake of the atoms. And so as I bring it to absolute zero, the amount of shake or the amount of velocity of the total atom goes to a very low number. However, if helium is still helium, if hydrogen is still hydrogen, if iron is still iron, it's got to have the same number of protons in the nucleus and the same number of electrons going around that nucleus, and those electrons have to be in motion. I think as you bring it to absolute zero, you're removing the kinetic energy of the total atom. That doesn't mean you're slowing down the electrons. Those electrons are only going to be at that radius away from that nucleus if they're moving at that normal speed by which the centrifugal force keeps them from colliding. A lot of people want to believe, and here I'm not sure, but a lot of people want to believe that the motion of the electrons around the nucleus, let me drop.
Let me make some.
They want to believe that the motion of the electrons around the nucleus are going to stop at absolute zero. I say no. If you could stop them from moving around that nucleus, then the positive protons in the nucleus and the negative electrons out there that are no longer moving, they're just going to crash into each other. And you don't have that same substance anymore. I'd like to believe that when I cryogenically cool something to a microkelvin, if I started off with helium, hydrogen, iron, whatever, and I cool it to a microkelvin and I study it, and at later time I bring it back up to room temperature, I've still got the exact same hydrogen, helium, iron, silicon, whatever. If you made the mistake of stopping the velocity of the electrons around that nucleus, then the electron would crash into the nucleus, and you don't have that atom anymore. You see where I'm going on that one, John? KC2WG, before a quick comment, and then pass it over to Wesley. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
KC2WGV. Okay, Dick, yes, I understand that. But do you think the radiation would still be emitted from something at absolute zero? And does that make sense?
Now, are you talking about T to the fourth thermal radiation, or are you talking about the nuclear radiation? The
nuclear, what we would read on the Geiger counter.
I don't know. But my first guess is the spontaneous, everything that you and I have done to the outside of that atom when we cryogenically cooled it, we stopped its physical motion. That's what temperature is, physical motion. So the whole atom is being translated or shaken. If it's in a lattice, it's being shaken. If it's in a gas or a liquid, it's really moving. And we can stop that overall translation. But that's, as far as that atom is concerned, you've done something to the outside. I don't think you've altered in any way the nucleus. And if the nucleus has an instability that causes it to give nuclear spontaneous radiation, I think with almost no change, it's going to continue to do it, even though you brought it down to microkelvins. That's my guess, John. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. I'm going to check that out because it could be either way, but I agree. I don't think you're going to change anything other than just making it cold. So you're going to stop all the vibration. The electrons probably would continue, otherwise exactly what you said would happen. Oh, interesting point. I'll turn it over to Wesley because I know he has more. KC2WGB.
Andreas here. At first, I would like to say thank you to Roy Laufer, AC2GS, Alpha Charlie 2, George Sierra. I hope he also shared his thoughts with Dick. He definitely did share it with Glenn. Absolutely unique personality. So. He actually states about his agreement to the fact of my claims in terms of the ability of and the resolution of the atomic force microscope and the scanning or transmission microscope, electron microscope. There is, of course, a difference in the semantics between Glenn and Roy, but the material is really very much enlightening, and this guy really has something to say. I'm going to ask Roy to give me permission to eventually post that to BerlinSpharmics.com if he agrees to that. Let me stop. Okay. Now, coming back to the discussion, I have had a few questions, and those were the questions to Dick, and I believe I've got an answer right now, which was, do you really think that there is no way that 200 megahertz wrench could make the permanent change to the steady matter? And I believe you don't. Also, do you really think that there is no way that certain free energy technologies are not welcomed by the powers of the world? Well, that I have no idea what you would say about it. Then I had another one which we don't have a time, and we will leave it for the next TechNet, which will be, what is magnetism? In molecular level as well. But we're not going to go to it. We have very little time left. There are very, very simple questions to ask, of course, not to answer. The answer would be probably more complicated than answer what really happened at 9/11. We're not going to this area. Some of the development in the area of so-called free energy movement. It may sound insane, but most of what I say is questionable, so what difference does it make if something is more or less questionable? Still questionable. There is a great chance that till the end of the year, that what I was waiting for is going to pop out. That means the device that is based on the Tesla coil which actually today I've got the confirmation that TK, and also not only the confirmation, but I also got the certain evidence that KTK was the first one that was using technology that was very much like an Akua, which is the guy from the Kazakhstan who made another device that needs only a few seconds to charge the device, and then the device works with no power supply at all. And right now, the most of the information is public domain, and it looks like everything is moving. Now, if it's going to move to the end of the year to the point of sort of revolution, that I've got my day. If it's not going to move, nothing will change, and we will just put my questions into the history files as irrelevant. But I believe we are very close to the point at which everything has to be rethought. That's why I brought the subject of the arrogance of being thick as a brick. Enter a GM.
It's very easy to be a naysayer. And I know it's awful easy to say that Dick just being a naysayer as to many of these things, like the above unity machines. The machines where you put in a small amount of energy and get a larger amount of energy out of them. And by way of YouTube videos, I don't know how many, but if I had to make a guess, if someone told me there are thousands of YouTube videos on that subject, I'd sort of believe it. And now we've got, let's call the people who are doing it, let's call them researchers. So we've got a large number of researchers, a large number of laboratories, a large number of countries, and yet none of these people are doing something that has become universally accepted. The fact that that many people are trying, you could, at first you'd say, well, TK has got it, and some conspiracy is keeping him from making it public, or he's holding it close to his chest because he wants a patent on it. Let me grab it. Is TK the only guy that has done it?
He's not only one. Right now we have one guy in the Kazakhstan, former Republic of Russia. The guy has made the device. The device is working. I personally know the guy. I personally know another guy who witnessed that device working. And we have a partial release of the technology to the public. And I could say also based on my involvement. And it looks like we're going, or we have a great chance to have it released till the end of the year. So my question is, because you say, well, it's something happening. Do you really think that there is no way that certain free technologies are not welcomed by powers of this world? And what would happen if, say, that at this time happened?
Does TK or anyone else have an explanation for where the excess energy is coming from? Over to you, Wes.
I believe they do, because the changes are actually not only days, but hours right now. Because TK is still trying to keep a certain secrecy, the other guy is not really very much secret. Of course, he would like to have a partner, but he's young, he's ambitious, and he is very much emotional. And that would actually make him vulnerable to just being a brick. A brick in a sense of, I don't give it out, or die with it. Let me go. One of the explanations is that using the Tesla coil, we create sort of artificial pump. That pump is actually requesting balance. So we have a coil, but the coil has a very much capacitive character, so the frequency of the resonance is a little bit higher than the frequency of resonance of that coil. From the other side of that coil, we have another coil that is loosely coupled with it, and that coil is connected to the satellite. We could picture it as the first coil is a capacitor connected to the ground. Now, the request comes from the upper part of the capacitor to eventually push the electrons from the ground to balance that capacitor. But once the capacitor is balanced, which is not really a capacitor, it's a capacitive reactance of the coil, of coil capacitor, say, then the receiving coil is making this balance again. We have a slight time difference, and the time difference is being made through the sort of PLL, which is actually a phase lag regulator. Now, this energy goes to the light bulb, and the light bulbs are not really that you can have as many light bulbs as you want. No, you gotta have to have a very much specific impedance of this part of the circuitry. So if you plug one more light bulb or one less light bulb, the system is not going to work. So right now the system is pretty much dynamic. Now, till actually today, we didn't really very much know, or at least I didn't know very much, how the pump works. And I, as I say, because the situation changes, and I'm very much pro the fact that technology should be the property of humanity, which somebody can laugh, but I don't care from that. I believe that we have a sufficient amount of information right now for the huge number of people be able to repeat it. And what is the result? Well, that's what I stated publicly already. If 1,000 people would be able to make the 100, if 1,000 people would be able to make at least 1,000 devices around the world, it's going to spread like a disease. But at this time, for the benefit of humanity. And to Andrea.
There's not much history saying that you don't get something for nothing, but there is no real perpetual motion machine.
I didn't say it's a perpetual motion machine. I said that. Energy must come from somewhere, be changed to the form of energy at which we can benefit from.
Okay. If you have an above unity energy machine, where is the excess energy coming from? Does anybody have an explanation that sounds logical as to where the excess energy is coming from?
Few answers to it. It is not only one way to go to the Washington. You can go to the Washington from many ways. It is not only one free energy device that makes it. There are plenty of them, plenty of different technologies. And the free energy is not the energy from nowhere. It's the energy free of charge. That's what is free energy. In case of Lithuania experiments that I was witnessing by myself, we are getting energy at least. We think we were getting energy from the nuclear bonds of that very much particular ferrite. In terms of a TK device, we didn't know what energy is coming from, but we have, by comparison to another gentleman, we have right now the information that if we take the theory of the pump, we have the electron actually trying to balance the structure. At the presence of the medium, and the presence of the medium is very high electrostatic field. So, because everything comes then to the background of Tesla, and two technologies are somehow, as of today, covering each other, the TK technology and the technology of the Kazakhstanian guy, I think that we are pretty much at the point of changing a lot in the life of the people. But if it's not happened, I wouldn't be worried, because
it wasn't righted the first time. Till the next time.
Wes, if the TK's best machine that you have witnessed, has anyone else ever built one? And maybe the answer is no, because he's holding it very close to his chest. He thinks he's got something of value, and he's not yet releasing it. If he's the only person who has one, and no one else has one, and you and I would like to believe that sometime in the near future, 1,000 people are going to be able to build one, what is that based on? How do we know 1,000 people can build it, and 1,000 people are going to get success? Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Okay, hear what I said. TK is trying to keep the secret. But based on what he showed, there is another guy who built it. There are actually three guys who have a possession of it. And the information is spreading out. The basic of that is simply by high voltage transformer that is powered at the primary at 12 volts, and the secondary is connected to the BPLR coil. And the BPLR coil then acts as a receiver. On that BPLR coil you have another coil that is winded. Now, the capacitor or capacitive reactance is being achieved by putting a very thick rod inside that coil. And then that rod goes through the spark gap and goes to the ground. Now, the spark gap acts as the square wave signal, the square wave generator. By regulating the gap of it, which is actually nothing more but the Tesla coil. It also has a cup, so the high voltage transformer is connected to this coil that I said, and the other side of this coil is simply in the air. But there is a rod inside that coil, and that rod inside the coil is connected to the spark gap, and through the spark gap is connected to the ground. With one slight difference. There is a 100 ohm resistor in between, and that's our load. And to engineer.
Does the resonant coil on the Tesla with the spark gap have a mechanism that anyone has recognized by which more energy can come out than was put in? LUS, K2LIW.
There is no such thing as a free lunch, Dick. The energy must come from somewhere and be utilized. I explain you one of the skewers that we attach to it, which is the pump. And that electrostatic pump using the capacitive reactance is one of the explanations of it. As far as the Litvinenko experiment, it was nuclear magnetic resonance that we attached to it. Now, the reason that I give you that video is because, and I gave you that explanation, is because nothing is certain. What makes my explanation less certain than the explanation of anything else that is uncertain? Think you gotta understand that if our uncertainty is a factor in most of the physics, and that the physics is changing from time to time, now we have a theory of the Big Bang, maybe there is something that you don't believe or you have a hard time to believe till the time that you start to believe.
About 1 minute, guys.
Oh, there's lots of things that my original belief was wrong on, and later on I found a better belief. But of all the beliefs that seem to be traceable to bedrock in the field of science over a good number of years, the so-called law of conservation of energy seems to be an extremely strongly held belief by a lot of people. Do any of these above unity machines appear to be violating the so-called law of conservation of energy? N2XJN, K2LIW.
So I think we're not violating this particular rule. We're just getting the energy that's unexplained by the mainstream science. That's all it is. But if it's going to happen, and if it's going to happen till the end of the year, we have a huge, enormous change in everything that you have seen so far.
Question for you, Wes. Pat, did you ask Akua about my idea of the second coil added to it?
I didn't have a contact with him as of yet, but he knows about it. It was brilliant.
Forget the delay, but this was TechNet 1474. I think we'll be back next week. John, Paul, Dick, and can't even remember the names of everybody here. Hal, we'll be back next week, and we'll try to find out a little bit more about what Mother Nature is telling us about all these systems. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW, clear. Bye-bye, John.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector. Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126. Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector. Link active.